This summer, I've been trying to blast my way through a gigantic biography of a fellow named Thomas Cromwell. Now, this Cromwell is not the one that you're probably thinking about, who is Oliver Cromwell, who would come about 75 years later after the Thomas Cromwell that I'm speaking of right now. Oliver was actually his great-great-nephew, but we don't have time to get into that. That Oliver Cromwell gets into his own trouble, and perhaps we'll talk about that some other time. But Thomas Cromwell is quite possibly the most influential person in the history of England that you just don't know about, and that's the reason why I'm reading the biography, is because I felt the need to know more about him as well. He was the high royal counselor advising Henry VIII in the midst of those most violent and dangerous times in the 1530s into 1540, and would have continued to advise except for the fact that he lost his head on the chopping block at the Tower of London. That was back when politics was real. But I mentioned Thomas Cromwell only to get me to the will of Henry VIII, which Cromwell fashioned but never saw because of the fact that he had left this life on to glory. But Henry VIII's will was one of the most influential wills ever composed by a body of legal minds. And the reason why it was the most influential of wills was that it determined the right of succession after Henry VIII. Much of Cromwell's story is wrapped up into that great drama, succeeding, who would succeed Henry VIII to the English throne. The House of Tudor had come out of a great struggle that you know of as the War of the Roses, and Henry VIII committed his whole life to making sure that he could get a successor, hence all those wives. He didn't have all those wives because he wanted more than one. He was looking for a successor. And that's the reason why this will was so important. This will established who would be king next. And of course, if you know your English history, you'll know that finally he got that son, Edward VI. And so the young man took the throne after his father died in 1547, and only reigned a very few years, about 8 years. He was the boy king. And after he died, sadly, he was succeeded by his sisters, Mary and Elizabeth, in order, established by the will. And the will also established who would be in succession should they pass. And they were the children of both of his sisters. Between the two of them, four more in succession. So you see that Henry VIII's will was one of the most important documents in the history not only of England, but also of the West. The United States history springs up out of this great succession, a will. Now, this sermon is not an advertisement for our guild of lawyers here at the parish, but it is simply to get you to think about a will. Everybody should have a will. It clarifies for your family, as it did Henry VIII, it clarifies for your family who's in and who's out. That's what wills do. This is the family. This is not the family. These are the people who have claim upon my estate. These are the people who don't. Now, Henry VIII, as you may know, had lots of other children that may have laid claim to his estate, but they were not listed for various reasons. But nonetheless, that's what wills are for, to list who's in and list who's out. Then, having established who's in and who's out, then to distribute all of the estate. Of course, as we see in Henry's will, it was the kingdom, right? The great and glorious British Empire that was developing right under his nose that Elizabeth I would cast across the face of the globe, as we know. But nonetheless, wills say who's in the family, who's out of the family, and then what to do with the stuff. And everybody should have a will. I say that at my annual rector's report every year. It's coming up here the first Sunday in December, and you'll hear me say it again. You owe your children the duty of stipulating in your will. Why? Well, it shields your family from predatory taxes levied against your estate by the government. And it also attempts to definitively answer that question that all of your family argues about once you have died, which is, what is it that they wanted? You hear that all the time. Well, it's what they really wanted. Well, if what they really wanted, they would have put it in the will. So put it in the will so that there's no question as to what you wanted. And Paul, today in our epistle lesson, tells us that God has a will, and it tells us what he wanted, or indeed what he wants, even to this very day. Paul says to these newly converted Christians in Turkey, that's where Galatia was, he tells them definitively that God said what he wanted. Paul's opponents in the church in Galatia were like people today who try to sneak in and grab a copy of the will and a Sharpie pen and go through and redact the will. Now, we have eagle-eyed lawyers who are trying to keep that from happening, but nonetheless, it happens all the time that people try to get in and redact the will, writing things in or scribbling things out to keep it from happening the way that the deceased wanted it to happen. And Paul says that the people that have caused such great anxiety among the newly converted Christians, these Gentile Christians in Turkey, causing such great agitation among them, were like those people with the Sharpie. These agitators in the church in Galatia were telling these newly converted Gentile Christians that they had to become a Jew first before they could become children of God. That believing in Jesus and being baptized into the faith once delivered to the apostles was not enough. They were trying to write into that will that they must become Jews before they could become Christians. What did that mean, to become a Jew? Well, to keep all of Moses' law, all of the stipulations about the ceremonies and the festivals, that they should be circumcised in their flesh, that they should eat the kosher diet, not eating those unclean items. And they must keep all of the festivals like Passover and the Day of Atonement and all of the other Jewish festivals to be Christians. They had to become Jews. For as the agitators tell these newly converted Gentiles in Galatia, God's people are defined by the law, the Torah. Who's in? Who's out? But Paul, in our lesson today, says very specifically, no, that's not true. Paul says that God's will had been filed with the heavenly attorneys 430 years earlier. He had filed his will, and his will was the covenant that he made with Abraham 430 years before he gave the law to Moses. And what was the promise? I will establish my covenant between me, says God, and you, Abraham, and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your offspring after you. So says God to Abraham. Paul, in his letter to the Galatians, says these words about that will, that covenant. He says, just as Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness, know then that it is those of faith who are the sons of God. And sons of Abraham, excuse me. Know then that it is those of faith who are the sons of Abraham. And the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, in you shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. So then, says Paul, those who are of faith are blessed along with Abraham, the man of faith. This is God's will, that those who believe in the Son that is to come will find themselves drawn up into the very family of God. God's family, you see, is not built upon the law given to Moses. God's family is based upon Abraham's faith. And anyone who believes in God's promises the way that Abraham believed can be sure that they are in God's family. As glorious as God's law was given by fire and smoke upon Mount Sinai, it couldn't change the will that had been made 400 years earlier. And that will was to establish a family that would save the whole wide world. The inheritance, you see, the inheritance of family membership is not based upon being a Jew, but instead it's based upon believing that God is the God who raises the dead back to life. That's it. The will of God established with Abraham 400 years before he ever gave the law to Moses establishes that his family is for all nations who believe in the promises that he made to Abraham. So we might rightly ask, why did God give the law at all? It seems as though it's a nasty trick. And the answer is simply this, that the world has a sin problem. You know it, and I know it. You're not as good a person as you wish that you yourself were. You look at yourself in the mirror in the morning when you're brushing your teeth, and you remember that you could have done better. The world has a sin problem. And even Abraham and his family were trapped in sin. What happens? This is a question for our doctor guild as opposed to our legal guild. What happens when you have an outbreak of a really lethal disease, not just in your neighborhood, but around the country and around the world? You quarantine. We learned about that a few years ago. What happens when the disease is so overwhelmingly bad that even the doctors get sick? You quarantine it. And that's exactly what the law was for. God gave the law to Moses and to Israel to trap sin, to contain it, to kill it, to hold it still until the last great inoculation could arrive that would finally defeat the power of the sickness that we call sin. The law was to hold back the power of sin until the promised child of Abraham came to defeat it. And Paul says to the Galatians, that child was not Isaac. That child was Jesus. When God fulfilled his promises and he sent his own son to die upon the cross and rise again, that was the moment in which the power of sin was broken. That was the power of God over the power of sin. So I want to show you this morning that God has a will. And I know that you're tired of hearing me say that. But the will is simply this, that he would make a new people that would follow Jesus in faith. And that people would contain all nations, tongues, and languages. Even as the law had condemned sinners, now this new covenant made in his son Jesus forgives sins. Now Jesus, the one true son, the seed promised to Abraham, has defeated sin and has given to us the Spirit. And what is that inheritance that I mentioned to you before? The will establishes who's in the family. The will also establishes what they get. And the covenant, the will of God that he made with the world in his son Jesus, the promised son, promised to Abraham, all those who are in this family of faith, now they receive the greatest of inheritances. First, that we are forgiven of that sin that condemns us and kills us. The inheritance top line says, you're forgiven. And the second thing that those who are in this covenant family who receive the benefits of this will is that they now are a people. They were once not a people. They were once aliens to God. They were unknown, and now they are a people. Neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, neither male nor female, but all now are made new in Messiah. And the inheritance that they receive continues on, not simply that sandy, rocky, dirty place on the end of the Mediterranean world that we call Palestine or Israel today, but they are given the whole wide world. This whole world now is given into the hands of Jesus' brothers and sisters to rule in mercy, in justice, and in holiness. This is the inheritance of God's people. Finally, if all of that wasn't enough, the will says that we have been made free. Every human being in the world, I think, even in the 21st century, wonders, are they really free? Or are we under the powers of some kind of nefarious global conspiracy to keep us down? But Paul says no. That in Jesus we've been made free. Free to be the people that God made us to be to begin with. That we can live our lives in joy, but also live our lives in service to others who have not yet believed the good news. That God has a will, and that will is that the world be saved through His Son. Amen.